funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How vulnerable is our heavily networked society to the ravages of cybercrime? And why is it so hard to nab the hackers intent on disrupting legitimate business, stealing, and spying? Online crime threatens not only our personal finances, but entire economic sectors and indeed entire countries. For the bad guys, the risks of actually being caught and prosecuted are so attractively low that some have set up websites where outlaws can buy and sell hacking services, credit card data, and password information. Author Misha Glenny is a former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC. He writes about one such site and the valiant efforts of one FBI agent to infiltrate and cripple it in his new book, Dark Market: Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Misha, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris.
I wonder if you would start by describing all the things that can be characterized in the modern world as cybercrime, because there is a really wide net out there.
Yes, it's very difficult trying to define cybercrime, but we have two sort of overall categories. One is crime, traditional crime, that is assisted by cyber. So if we take something which a lot of people will be familiar with, which is the so-called Nigerian 419 scams.
Right.
This is when you get those emails asking you to get your bank account ready to receive $13.5 million from some deceased dictator. And then you're asked by the person who's got in touch with you to forward $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 to facilitate this transfer. And of course, they keep the $5,000 and then you never hear from them again. Now, if you look at that crime, the 419 scam, you can go back to the 16th century and the play by the Elizabethan playwright Ben Jonson, The Alchemist, at whose very heart is that type of fraud. But what happened in the early 90s is a group of Nigerian fraudsters got hold of this and a fax machine and started proliferating the fraud using the fax. Once email came along, you are no longer restricted to sort of 5,000 recipients. You can have millions of recipients in one go. And so even if you only have a take-up of 0.001%, you can still make a huge amount of money out of this fraud. Now, that is usually dealt with by cyber divisions, and that is fraud that is assisted by cyber. Then you have the more pure cyber crime, which is when your computer is attacked, as happened recently to the Texas-based firm Stratfor, when their computer servers were hacked into by the group Anonymous, and credit card details and passwords of their clients and email addresses were stolen. That is a relatively low-end attack by Anonymous. You can get much more sophisticated crimes which involve hacking into companies, servers, or individuals, individual computers. Those are the two basic things we're talking about when it comes to cyber crime. But you also have cyber industrial espionage, which is the stealing of information from your competitors in order to give yourself an advantage in the marketplace. There is a lot of that goes on worldwide. And Verizon, in their latest computer fraud report, estimate that this is about 34-35% of computer crime. And then you have the spectacular cyber warfare section, the military aspect of cyber, where you know the threat ultimately is of what people refer to as digital Pearl Harbor or Cybergeddon, where entire systems of a country's infrastructure can be brought down, theoretically leading to a disaster in a very short space of time. But those three areas, cybercrime, cyber industrial espionage, and cyber warfare, are useful guidelines for us to think about the threats in cyber.
So the challenge you gave yourself in writing this book, Misha, was was to truly understand the people behind these crimes, as well as the people who are fighting these crimes. What did it take for you to track down these hackers, gain their trust, and know that they were telling you the truth?
Well, it took me many months, in some cases years, mm-hmm. in order to track them down. Now, I was fortunate in one respect that about half of the criminal hackers who I spoke to were in jail. So at least I knew where they were. Mm-hmm. Just because someone's in jail, it doesn't mean that you've secured an interview with them yet. First of all, you have to get over the local authorities, who are often very obstructive about interviewing people in jail. And then you have to get agreement from the hackers themselves. But they were undoubtedly the easiest lot to talk to. And three or four critical players in the dark market story were in prison and were happy to talk to me. Much more difficult was tracking down those people who are still active cyber criminals who were involved in dark market. And this involved sort of tortuous forms of communication through interlocutors, through websites which are used by hackers and the underground, and persuading them, explaining them to talk to me. Now, I have one advantage in as much that my previous book, McMafia, which was about more traditional global organized crime, has developed a certain renommé, a certain reputation amongst criminal groups around the world. And so some of the people who I approached had already read McMafia and were happy to speak to me on the strength of that, because that was also based on speaking to active criminals. But for me, in order to understand what's going on in the cyber underground, it is absolutely crucial that one tracks down and talks to hackers themselves, because, first of all, they're always two or three steps ahead of law enforcement. Secondly, they are not quite the same as traditional criminals. They are often a lot smarter than traditional criminals. And, you know, I found discussing with them, first of all, there was a lot of interest about the actual work that they do as criminals, but they also had very interesting perspectives on the internet, its impact on society, and where this is all heading. None of it was particularly optimistic, I have to say.
I was really interested to read that many of these hackers have absolutely no criminal records in the offline world. What do you think makes them willing to commit cybercrimes when they wouldn't dream of stealing a car or mugging somebody on the street?
Well, there's no question that if you look at the profile of the people who I have interviewed and got to know, but also other hackers around the world who have been exposed or who have revealed themselves, that first of all, these people tend to develop their hacking skills aged between about 12 to 15. Hmm. So they're young when it happens. They generally, not always, but generally have advanced ability in maths and or the sciences, usually physics. Quite often, they demonstrate rather poor skills when it comes to social communication in the real world. A lot of the people you come across in the hacking world, if they were being examined under clinical conditions, would conform to symptoms usually associated with Asperger's syndrome or even autism. And because they develop their skills and find this fantastic world in which they are highly regarded because they're so smart and good at what they do, it is very easy for less scrupulous people in the cyber underworld to encourage and recruit these people, particularly since, if we remember their age, 12 to 15, say, their moral compass by this stage has not yet properly developed.
Sure.
And so they often become involved in criminal activity incrementally without being fully aware that that's what they're doing. And by the time age 19 or 20, they've woken up to the fact that they are deep, deep, deep into the underground, they don't really have the ability or the knowledge as to how they extract themselves from that.
Yeah, so as recently as 5 or 10 years ago, a lot of cyber criminals were sort of these one-off, you know, criminal masterminds coming up with their own software and the plot to steal money and things like that. And now there are, like Dark Market, these sites that bring together people with the technical expertise who don't necessarily have criminal intentions and people who want to make a lot of money and need somebody really smart to help them do
and,
it.
And do have criminal intentions.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, this all began, the forums began in earnest in 2001 with a website that was called Carta Planet, and which was set up by a group of Ukrainians in Odessa, and was able to mobilize the considerable computing skills of young people in the former Soviet Union, combined with their experience in the post-Soviet world, which was an experience of what we know as gangster capitalism. Mm-hmm. So their entire social formation was in a criminalized environment, but they also were able to use the internet. And what they discovered, that this was the time when commerce on the internet, particularly in Western Europe and the United States, Japan and Korea, was really getting going big time. Security on the part of companies engaged in internet commerce was relatively poor at this time as well. And that applied to banks in addition to ordinary companies. Now, the Ukrainians hit upon this very, very quickly and used Carta Planet as a way for criminals all over the world to communicate with advanced computer skills. So Carta Planet was basically like any internet forum, you know, whether it's for parenting skills or beekeeping. You became a member, you signed in, you had a much heavier level of vetting than you did in a beekeeping or a parenting forum. And you would then go in, and you would be able to buy and sell credit card data, stolen credit card data. You'd be able to buy and sell the latest viruses. You could download tutorials on how to commit the most recently developed cyber crimes, and so on. And it was a big community which rapidly grew to about 7,000 members worldwide. And Carta Planet became the template for all future so-called carding websites. Now, Dark Market was the culmination of this and was the most prominent English language website. Carta Planet was originally in Russian, although it later had Chinese and English sections as well. Dark Market was the premier English language website from 2005-2008 before, as you pointed out earlier, it was brought down by an FBI agent, an undercover FBI agent who infiltrated the very heart of Dark Market. Once Dark Market was brought down in late 2008, then most of the criminals decided that model of the internet forum was too risky in terms of exposure to law enforcement and intelligence agents, and indeed to criminals who did not conform to the code of honor amongst thieves. Mm. So after Dark Market came down, you then saw a shift to basically people communicating one-to-one with each other. They'd already established the relationships over the forum, but also the emergence of much more sophisticated criminal networks that look a lot more like traditional organized crime syndicates operating on the web. And of course, 2008, the end of Dark Market, coincided with the collapse of Lehman Brothers almost to the month and the beginning of a worldwide recession.
Let me jump in here, Misha. We need to take a quick break. My guest is author Misha Glenny. His new book is called Dark Market: Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Misha Glenny. He's former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC and author of the new book Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Misha, you were reminding us that Lehman Brothers imploded at almost exactly the same time that Dark Market was brought down, and then we are plunged into this global recession.
Yeah, we get plunged into the recession, and this is a very interesting thing, that when recessions happen, it has an impact on traditional organized crime, traditional commodity and service-based organized crime. And that is essentially consumers of the goods and services of organized crime, those people who take drugs or sleep with prostitutes and the like, have less disposable income. And so they tend to spend less money on recreational drugs and other goods and services provided by organized crime. So this poses a threat to the business model of traditional organized crime groups. And what we always see at this time is a rise in fraudulent activity. And what happened in 2008 is those organized crime groups who started looking to see what frauds they could commit and what was going on in the financial world that they could exploit, discovered that the internet had made financial fraud a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't understand exactly how you use the internet to commit fraud, but of course they knew people who did. So one of the things that I uncovered while I was doing the research for Dark Market was that you have basically, you have sort of three circles of people involved in internet crime. One are the sort of geeky, nerdy types who we talked about before, who tend to be at the front line and who tend to be doing the technical stuff and, as a consequence, are more exposed to law enforcement investigation. The second group are young guys who have and we're almost always talking about men, because about 95% of people involved, certainly in hacking, but also in internet crime in general, 95% are men. And these guys from the second group tend to be young, relatively tech-savvy people who come from traditional organized criminal syndicate backgrounds. And they act as intermediaries between the geeks and between the elders of traditional organized crime groups. So this was basically the vector, as it were, of how you saw traditional organized crime groups becoming ever more interested in internet crime, as they recognized that A, it was very useful for fraudulent activity, but B, it's relatively low risk and it's high returns, which is one of the reasons why, although we've seen a lot more money poured into internet security and indeed law enforcement regarding cybercrime, that we've actually continued to see a steady rise of returns to the criminals from cybercrime since 2008. And the whole sort of scene of cyber criminal activity has shifted quite a lot, so that you get much more sophisticated operations engaged now in cyber criminal activity, divided up into different sections. So you'll have one guy who's responsible only for writing viruses, one guy who's responsible only for so-called herding botnets, that's bringing together and deploying computers that have been infected by viruses and which the cyber criminals can control, and then one person who's responsible for making sure the money from a cyber crime is channeled through so-called money mules and gets to the boss who's organizing the whole thing. It's a very different atmosphere from the days of Dark Market in 2008.
So let's talk, Misha, about why it is so low risk. For one thing, if I am let's pretend here that I am a criminal mastermind living in Dallas, Texas, I can hire somebody in Ukraine to create the hacking programs that I need. I can rip off somebody in Great Britain and I can deposit the money in Switzerland. And then you have all these jurisdictions and it's not quite clear who should be in charge of finding the people who are guilty.
Well, let me tell you a concrete case of a poor chap called Roger Mildenhall, who was from Australia. He was working in South Africa, and in Australia he had two houses near Perth, which effectively represented his pension plan. But he was working in South Africa, and his one day last year, in about July of last year, well, no, sorry, it was September of last year, he got a phone call from a neighbor. And the neighbor said, I understand why you might have wanted to sell your first house, but why are you putting the second house on the market? And Roger Mildenhall said, what are you talking about? I don't know anything about this. And he discovered that somebody had sold his first house and was about to sell his second house. Mm. And it emerged that his email account had been hacked into by a group of Nigerian hackers who had gone through all his emails and discovered copies of the title deeds to his house in his email account. They had then contacted a local real estate agent in near Perth who had and instructed them to put the house on the market. The house was sold, and the money was then sent to a bank in China from which it was successfully laundered. Now, if you're launching an investigation into that crime, who is responsible? Is it the Nigerian police, where the perpetrators were, the South African police, where Mr. Mildenhall was located, the United States law enforcement agencies, because he was using a .com web-based email system, so it comes under U.S. jurisdiction, the Australian police, where the house was sold, or the Chinese police, through which because China was the country through which the money was laundered? Hmm. And the answer is, of course, nobody has the jurisdiction to do it. So you have this what was always a problem when it came to transnational crime was the problem of local jurisdiction, but the crime being committed across several countries. This is magnified by internet crime because of the fact that, A, you can't sort of trail it physically from one country to another necessarily, and because the laws pertaining to cyber change so dramatically from territory to territory that it is extremely difficult for law enforcement agents to create effective networks across borders. So you have a totally globalized crime and a very local law enforcement jurisdiction situation. It's a real nightmare.
And on top of that, you know, we hear often about these crimes originating in former Soviet bloc countries, and it turns out that in Russia and some other places in that region, governments are happy to turn a blind eye as long as their citizens are not being affected.
Yeah, well, it's been most dramatic in Russia itself, and if you talk to U.S. law enforcement, if you talk to the feds or British law enforcement, they tear their hair out when it comes to trying to establish effective cooperation with the MVD, the Russian Interior Ministry, or indeed the KGB or the FSB, as it's now called. Now, why is that? Well, the BRIC countries, in particular Brazil, Russia, and China, turned out to be the most important incubators for cybercrime in the 1990s and the first decade of this century. That's because, of course, we had that lawless situation associated with economic transition, which affected all of these countries, and limited law enforcement capacity. However, the FSB, KGB in Russia put a lot of effort into monitoring what was going on in cyber, and they actually have a rather frightening Orwellian system called SORM2, which forces all ISPs, internet service providers in Russia, to send a mirror image of every single bit of data that crosses the internet in Russia to central servers in Moscow for the FSB to monitor. So they know everything that is going on. Now, when Carta Planet, the original carding forum, emerged in Ukraine, the Russians approached the law enforcement approached the guys who administered Carta Planet and were explicit in the deal. The deal was, you can attack anyone you like in terms of credit card fraud in Western Europe, the United States, Japan, and elsewhere, but you must not touch any of the financial institutions or state institutions in the former Soviet Union. Hmm. In exchange for that, we will leave you be, unless we require you for assistance when it comes to national security issues. So here you see a quid pro quo, and that this actually happened in 2007 when a massive cyber attack was launched from Russian territory onto the Baltic state of Estonia in the wake of a rather small dispute between the two states. And this was so serious that Estonia had to disconnect itself from the international internet for 4 or 5 days to sort out the problem. Now, so here you see a connection between people engaged in criminal hacking and the broader national security issues that affect cyber warfare. And that is because you have two human agencies who flit from those three original categories I was talking about, cyber crime, cyber industrial espionage, and cyber warfare. And they are the hackers and members of intelligence agencies who are engaged in cyber. Now, recently there has been evidence that both Russia and China, who have been heavily criticized by the United States and by Western Europe for their cyber espionage activity and their tolerance of cyber crime as well emanating from those territories, there is evidence that both Russia and China are actually getting quite concerned about the extent of espionage and criminality on the web. And there may be, and I certainly hope so, some way in which the major internet powers can start cooperating together when it comes to the regulation of the internet in terms of crime and law enforcement. But at the moment, the internet is pretty chaotic, and what governments are doing is they are tending to restrict activity on their own territory. I mean, basically, they've woken up to the fact that the internet is far too powerful and far too important to be let alone in the hands of ordinary citizens like you and me. And so there's a real tension here with issues of civil liberties and internet freedom as well. It's an incredibly complex but important issue which will affect all of international and domestic relations in the next decade or so.
Misha Glenny is my guest. His new book is called Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Our email address is think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bill in Dallas, who writes, did you know that the perpetrator of the famous MMM pyramid scheme is about to launch MMM2 over the internet? Even though everyone knows it was a complete scam, there are plenty of Russians who are ready to put their money into the second one. Bill writes, he even went on Russian TV to announce it.
Well, of course, at the heart of fraud, like the pyramid scheme and like the pyramid schemes and like MMM, which was an astonishing fraud in the 1990s in Russia and had a huge societal impact on that country, at the heart of it, unfortunately, is ordinary people's gullibility. A lot of internet criminals and people engaged in wide-scale fraud rely on the theorem that there is one born every minute, that there's a sucker born every minute. And in times of recession, of course, the number of people who are prepared to risk their money in schemes like pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes like MMM, increases because a large number of people are more desperate, mm-hmm. and they are sort of urgently looking for ways out of the poverty trap, which recession triggers all over the place. So, at the time when you have fewer options and less money, you have to think very, very hard about what you're being offered, because there are always unscrupulous people there who are trying to part you from your hard-earned money, even if you don't have very much of it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Arlington. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Your guest mentioned Asperger's syndrome earlier, and that's a disorder I've heard associated with the so-called internet trolls, but not so much with hackers and cyber criminals. And I was wondering if your guest did find that there's any commonality between disorders, even either psychological or otherwise, and the sort of people who get involved in this kind of work. And if he finds that there is a distinct personality type that tends to get attracted to this kind of activity as well.
Well, I would say that of the criminals that I interviewed, and the ones I interviewed in depth were about 10 of them, I would say about 5 to 6 were close in terms of their behavioral traits to Asperger's. And I didn't rely on myself because I'm not a clinician myself and I don't know about this. So I went to see the professor of developmental psychology at Cambridge University, Simon Baron Cohen, who is one of the world's leading experts on Asperger's and autism and is frequently used by the courts in the United Kingdom in cases related to computer crime to pronounce on whether the people involved suffer from Asperger's or not. And he confirmed my sort of anecdotal and interviewing findings by saying that this was frequently the case, that people involved in Asperger's, people with Asperger's could become involved in cybercrime. But I want to say that it is not exclusively people with Asperger's, nor do people with Asperger's necessarily become involved in computer crime.
Yeah, certainly the vast majority do not become involved in crime at all. But
No, exactly. And you know, but what is important is that they, you know, when it comes to exploring the internet, it's a fantastic outlet for their skills, because I think that sometimes people misunderstand that people with Asperger's often have remarkable gifts, which are fantastically valuable for society. Now, we have a big case in the United Kingdom, which is related to the United States, which is the case of Gary McKinnon, who the United States are desperate to extradite in order to put him on trial. And Simon Baron Cohen indeed was asked to give a second opinion to the British courts. And he says there is no question but that this man, McKinnon, who did not steal any money or anything like that, he hacked into some Pentagon computers because he wanted to see whether there were...
Let me stop you once again. I'm sorry, Misha. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Misha Glenny, author of Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC, author Misha Glenny. His new book is called Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You were talking before the break, Misha, about this case. The U.S. is seeking the extradition of Gary McKinnon.
That's right. And the reason why I wanted to highlight it is because of the fact that McKinnon is undoubtedly Asperger's. He's been diagnosed as such, as well as having a secondary condition of clinical depression. Now, one of the things that emerged, I'm now a visiting professor at Columbia University here in New York, and one of the projects I want to start here in cooperation with a variety of different instances around the world is to set up a study of hackers and try and work out two things. First of all, how can you reintegrate hackers back into society? Because our criminal justice system, which a part of the criminal justice system is about rehabilitation, has at the moment absolutely no capacity to rehabilitate hackers. And it has a very, very sort of punitive approach to hackers. And these are people with incredibly valuable skills who I think can do a lot of good for society. In addition to that, we wanted to, it would be very handy to try and identify people as they're developing their hacking skills in their early teens and to try and assist them so that they can use these very advanced abilities that they have in a way that is both positive for them and positive for society as a whole. Now, what I want to try and do with that is get people from lots of different disciplines, from psychology, from computers, from computer technology, from the private sector, from anthropology, because at the moment we tend to look at cybersecurity and the issues coming out of cybercrime and espionage purely as a technology issue, as a security and technology issue. But the people engaged in it are very, very complex, very interesting. And because we are now so dependent on networked computer systems, we have to have a much broader look at the issues related to criminality, to security, to warfare, and so on and so forth than has been the case hitherto. So we have to start creating a cross-disciplinary approach to this, which is one of the things I want to try and get going here.
And it would be great to understand what, for some of these individuals, tips the balance. There is the really interesting case that you write about in the book of Max Vision.
Yes. God, what a story. Max is currently in prison in Lompoc, California. He was an incredibly gifted computer user who was a so-called penetration tester in California in the late 1990s. Now, a penetration tester is a hacker who is paid by corporations to hack into their systems so that they can identify where their vulnerabilities lie. Mm-hmm. And Max was very, very good at this and very well paid, but he was also, by nature, incredibly inquisitive and curious. And he spent all of his life just hacking into anything he could find. And he discovered in the late 1990s that there was a specific vulnerability affecting all U.S. government computer systems, including systems, for example, at the Livermore Nuclear Lab. So these were very important vulnerabilities. And Max basically decided to patch them up so that nobody, the Russians, the Chinese, nor anyone else, would be able to hack into them. But he created a tiny little wormhole through which he alone could wriggle because of the fact that he was an inveterate hacker. And this was spotted by an investigator and resulted in Max getting a 2-year sentence, which he was required to serve at an open prison in California. Now, open prisons, of course, is where you tend to get white-collar criminals and financial fraudsters. Mm-hmm. So these guys at the Taft Correctional Institute, who were already there, couldn't believe their luck when Max was sent to join them, who was basically a goose who laid golden eggs. And, of course, because he had a criminal record, when he came out of prison, he couldn't get a job. He couldn't get his teeth done. He had bad problems with his teeth, couldn't get an apartment. And out came a couple of these fraudsters who had befriended him in prison and put him to work as a criminal hacker who became really one of the finest criminal hackers the United States, if not the best, has ever seen, and who the FBI had tremendous difficulties in running down. And he was eventually arrested and sentenced to 13 years in prison last year in Pittsburgh. And I had the good fortune to interview him at length before he went to prison. And he's an extraordinary character, Max, who has such advanced computer skills that you kind of think it's absolutely crazy that he's sitting there wasting away in prison. Here's a man with a brain the size of a planet. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing elsewhere in the world is other countries are using the skills of hackers for their own purposes, be it Russia, be it China. They're mobilizing their hacking ability. Here in the West, and we suffer from the greatest number of cyber attacks on a daily basis, particularly the United States, we have a dearth of really good security personnel when it comes to cyber. And we need to start thinking out of the box of ways of integrating people who have clearly demonstrated their skills when it comes to cyber through their hacking ability, ways of integrating them back into society so those skills can be used for good as opposed to for ill.
Of course, we tend to do a poor job in this country of even integrating different government agencies. The FBI and the Secret Service are often working at cross-purposes.
Well, this was one of the astonishing things that I uncovered when I was researching Dark Market, which was revealed to me by an agency in Europe who came across the fact that at one stage, the FBI and the Secret Service were investigating each other's undercover agents on the assumption that they were real criminals. This was really incredible. So, I mean, as I looked further into it, of course, after 9/11, there was the new doctrine of cooperation between agencies to prevent to the worst excesses of interagency competition. And whilst there was a lot of rhetorical commitment to this, it didn't actually amount to a hill of beans in practical cooperation. So that on the one hand, you still get the Secret Service and the FBI vying against each other to try to be seen as the number one cyber agency, because of course there are potentially a lot of tax dollars to come your way if you're engaged in investigating cybercrime. And on the other hand, you get a sort of touchy-feely agency like the State Department sharing all its secrets and all its cables with 3 million people. And if you share your cables with 3 million people, eventually it's going to leak out. And so the post 9/11 doctrine of sharing was a complete catastrophe from both ends. It didn't prevent agency competition, as the Dark Market case clearly shows, and it encouraged the release of confidential documents into the wide, wide world.
So tell us a little bit more about this single heroic FBI agent, Keith Malarski, who ultimately was instrumental in bringing down Dark Market. He really is seems like a singularly devoted person.
He's an incredible guy, Keith, and he worked really hard at this. Of course, it wasn't just him. I mean, he had his his alter ego on the Dark Market boards, the administrator. I won't say his name because that gives away the story as to who done it, as it were, because I've written Dark Market as a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because the actual case was an extraordinary thriller. And Keith, of course, wasn't alone. He had a backup team working out of a very impressive operation called the NCFTA, the National Cyber Forensic Training Alliance in Pittsburgh, which tried to overcome the issues of interagency and private-public sector lack of cooperation. Pittsburgh is quietly turning itself into a very effective center for the development of computer security techniques by cooperation with the FBI and other agencies on the one hand, and the private sector and the Carnegie Mellon and other academic institutions there. And so Keith had this tremendous backup. He himself is really a great salesman, because we have to remember that about 80% of cybercrime is not about hacking and technical ability. It's about social engineering, the ability to persuade people on the internet to do stuff which is not actually in their interest, to get you to click on an infected link or to download something bad onto your computer. And Keith was effectively a great social engineer, persuading a lot of cyber criminals around the world that he was a really bad guy who was deeply involved in major spamming and other types of criminal activity on the web. And, you know, that was his real skill. He had the gift of the cyber gab, as it were, and did a fantastic job, particularly since he was at one point very close to being completely exposed by Max Vision, as it happens. And, you know, by acting very skillfully and by understanding the psychology of his supposed fellow hackers on the net, that's how he did it. It's the psychology that's important, often much more than the technology.
Are private security firms more open to considering the psychology factor right now than government agencies?
Not in my experience, no. Mm-hmm. No, I think there's some of the smaller private sector companies are, and some of the more innovative private sector companies go out and seek hackers to work for them, because they know just how advanced their skill is, and also that active hackers have a much better idea of what's really going on the web at any one time. But of course, the larger private sector companies are very nervous about employing hackers, because if anything were to go wrong and it were to emerge that someone had a criminal record, then of course that raises issues of liability. Mm-hmm. But I think what we're going to see, I'm not sure, but I think there are discussions around in government agencies now that maybe the time is coming where one has to mobilize the ability of criminal or industrial hackers on behalf of law enforcement and the state. Whether those hackers are prepared to engage with that or not, one doesn't know, because they're very different from in terms of their aims than people like Anonymous, the group who hacked into Stratfor criminal hackers. But they share with them a sort of half-baked anarchic philosophy, which sees the state basically as the enemy. And so they would have to reassess what they believe about the internet freedom and their role in it before they were able to sit down and discuss whether they could cooperate with state agencies.
So you've sort of specialized in covering the underworld for some time now, but I wonder if following the investigations you did for this book in particular, you have changed your behavior online at all.
Yes, I have. I tend to encrypt a lot more than I used to. Mm-hmm. I tend to keep offline material that needs to be kept offline. And that is really the key lesson that I got from looking into the cyber underworld, is that you cannot, if you go onto the internet, you cannot eliminate your risk totally. But what you can do is you can reduce that risk. And you can reduce it through very simple means. For the moment, and I have to say I have no commercial interest in this whatsoever, the easiest way is to switch from a Windows-based machine to an Apple, because virus writers go for Windows. It's not because Apples are necessarily better at combating viruses. It's just virus writers don't write very many viruses for Macs because they have a much reduced percentage of the market. 90% of all computers we use around the world are Windows-based, and so that's why they're vulnerable.
We'll need to leave it there. I'm so sorry, because we are out of time. Misha Glenny's new book is called Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. Misha, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
You're more than welcome. Thanks a lot.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.